So, I want to start off with a story about a tree, a fence, and a shed. Tree, a fence, and a shed. So, back on Good Friday, I don't know, about a month ago, right? High winds came through the Roanoke Valley. And for most people, it was probably a normal day, you know. It's windy, but it doesn't really affect much. But for me, the Robinson household, the high winds combined with a decaying tree in our neighbor's yard, and I think you might see where this goes, right? So there's the tree, there's the fence, and guess what? There's the shed. So this was in our backyard. I was sitting there playing video games with my friend, and I hear a bunch of debris hit our house, and I look outside, I'm like, oh, darn, like, what do I go do? So I go casually tell Elizabeth, and she's like, you should have, like, where was the urgency? I was like, well, I didn't think you'd hear anything else I said if I told you that this had happened first. And she was like, I didn't even know that happened. I was like, okay. So, so the tree came through the roof of our shed, broke our fence. And, I'm not going to bore you with all the insurance details and the frustrations we had. Ultimately, we didn't even end up filing it on insurance. But we had somebody come out, remove the tree, not something we were going to try to do on our own. I felt like I would probably collapse the entire shed if I tried. So we let somebody else come out, take care of the tree. But then I thought to myself, you know, I have a mother who in my childhood built an entire fence, built an entire shed from the ground up. I was like, you know, maybe I could save a nice penny and ask my mom to come out. I did. Short story, I did. And her and I spent the past couple weeks fixing the fence and fixing the shed, and they look pretty darn good, and we saved a good bit of money. So here's the pictures, right? The fence is fixed. We got our tree removed, and then the neighbors also got their tree removed. The shed, looking good. I think I hired the right person. That's all I'm saying. It's a pretty good shed. Guys, I mean, it saved a ton of money. And you may wonder, like, why are you even talking to me about your shed? Well, yes, I'm bragging on my mother. I'm also kind of bragging on myself. No, I'm kidding. I didn't do much. But there's some lessons I learned in repairing this shed, right? Like, to repair a shed, it requires wood and it requires effort. It requires frames and supports. And in essence, like, if it is not properly supported within the entire structure, it won't work. So like if I don't put a board down and then drill it into other boards, it's just going to fall out. There's nothing that will hold it. So whatever I tried to repair would fail. So everything is meant to work together to carry the load. No piece works in isolation. I also learned that none of this would have mattered if our shed wasn't built on a proper foundation. So like if it was just built on some slope, right, it wouldn't have mattered. Our shed wouldn't even be there in the first place. So I am no expert in construction. I'm no expert in carpentry. I'm no expert in any of this. Please hear me. I am no expert. But one thing I am pretty darn sure of is in order for structures to last and have resilience, some form of rock or concrete is usually placed underneath to create a level and stable surface for this thing to be built on. So what if I told you this morning that the church is much like this shed? Like, what if I told you that we need each other in order to function best? What if I told you that if we are not founded on a firm foundation, we too will crumble? And if you're looking for the weird in all of this, the weird belief, right, because we've been in a series, Weird Things Christians Believe, if you're looking for the weird in all of this, what if I told you that we believe Jesus does something supernatural when we meet together? Something that would not happen apart from him. Would not happen apart from the gathering of believers. So today, we are going to talk about the church. And we are going to hopefully answer some of the questions you may have heard or may have yourself. So we're going to do so through the story of Peter. What you need to know up to this point in the story is that Jesus is in the mode of predictions. And he likes to predict things. He predicted his death throughout his entire life, right? But he's in the mode of predictions. He has just spent time bending down, washing his disciples' feet. Even though he knows stuff about them, he knows that Judas is going to betray him, he knows that Peter is going to deny him, he spends time washing their feet. Then they have this meal, and he predicts that Judas is going to be the one that betrays him. So we'll pick up there in John 13, starting in verse 30, if you want to read along. As soon as Judas had taken the bread, he went out, and it was night. When he was gone, Jesus said, "Now the Son of Man is glorified, and God is glorified in him. If God is glorified in him, God will glorify the Son in himself and will glorify him at once." Whew, right? Short lesson. I could spend a whole sermon, and I would love to, because I've heard a lot of really cool teachings about the word glory or to glorify. But the essence of it is to reveal the heart of that thing. So if I'm going to glorify something, I'm going to reveal the heart of that thing. And so it's like I would show its truest nature. So if we replace the word glory here with reveal, which is not a one-to-one translation, but it might help us understand what he's saying, right? When he was gone, Jesus said, "Now the Son of Man is revealed, and God is revealed in him. If God is revealed in him, God will reveal the Son in himself and will reveal him at once." The idea is that we are going to see Jesus best in God and God best in Jesus' sacrifice. That's what he's saying, right? And then Jesus says to his disciples, "My children, I will be with you only a little longer. You will look for me, and just as I told the Jews, so I now tell you, where I am going, you cannot come. A new command I give you, love one another. As I have loved you, so you also must love one another. By this, everyone will know you are my disciples, if you love one another." He repeated it because it's important. He repeated it because they need to hear it, right? He's saying, soon I am going to be gone. He's, again, predicting that he is going to die, that he is going to be resurrected and ascend. All of that he's predicting. And he's saying, this is how my people are meant to distinguish themselves. This is how they're meant to act, to love one another. So we, as a body, just a quick lesson as we're going through it, we as a body are meant to love one another. And we're meant to love our neighbor as ourselves. We're meant to love the Lord with all our soul, mind, strength. So, we're meant to love. That's just a quick indicator. We are also, I don't know if you caught it, but the one another's. I highlighted it for a reason. One another's are so important. And I can't wait to get into it, but we're going to talk about it later in the sermon. So put a little pin in it. We're coming back. Simon Peter asked him, "Lord, where are you going?" Jesus replied, "Where I am going, you cannot follow, but you will follow later." Peter's like, "I don't get what you're saying." Like, he's like, "Lord, why can't I follow you now? Like, do you not get it? I would lay down my life. So whatever hindrance you're saying would keep me from following you, like, it's not there. I will go anywhere. I will do anything for you. Like, I will be with you. I'll lay down my life for you." And then Jesus answered, "Will you truly lay down your life for me? Very truly, I tell you, before the rooster crows, you will disown me 3 times. Again, Jesus likes his predictions, right? And this is his prediction. And we know from other accounts in the Gospels that Peter actually argues with Jesus over this. He's saying, "No, I am following you. Like, I will be with you." But Jesus knows something else. So we're going to continue in the story of Peter. But one thing that I think is worth noting is that even though somebody can be confident in their speech, it does not necessarily mean that they will be certain in their actions. That's just a human trait, right? Like, if somebody says, like, "I will meet you for lunch at noon," right? I show up to lunch at like 11:55, and there is like a 10% chance in my mind that they don't show or they're very late. Like, that, it just always goes through my head. And if they're really unreliable, I've given them like a 60% chance that they'll show, or, you know, like, it just varies on the person. But there's a true element to the human nature where we can be really confident in something. Even we can believe it fully. And it doesn't necessarily mean that when we play it out, it's going to work that way. And so Peter, I believe, has every desire to follow Jesus without wavering. But he's still a broken man. He's walking with God, but he is imperfect. So from this point, when Jesus has now predicted it, chapters of the book of John go by. And now it is time for Jesus to be arrested. So John 18, starting in verse 1. When he had finished praying, Jesus left with his disciples and crossed the Kidron Valley. And on the other side there was a garden, and his disciples went into it. Now Judas, who betrayed him, knew the place because Jesus had often met there with his disciples. So he's like, yeah, I know that Jesus will be here. So Judas came to the garden, guiding a detachment of soldiers and some officials from the chief priests and the Pharisees. They were carrying torches and lanterns and weapons. They're ready to take him by any means necessary. Jesus, knowing all that was going to happen to him, went out and asked them, who is it you want? And I always think this is funny, right? This happens over and over in the Bible. It's like, it says he knows all that is going to happen to him. And then he goes out and says, who do you want? Like, he doesn't know, right? Like, it's like, no, you just said that you know in the scriptures. So, like, why are you going out and saying, who do you want? Jesus of Nazareth, they replied. I am he, Jesus said. And Judas the traitor was standing there with them. And when Jesus said, I am he, they drew back and fell to the ground. Again, he asked them, who is it you want? Jesus of Nazareth, they said. Jesus answered, I told you that I am he. If you are looking for me, then let these men go. This happened so that the words he had spoken would be fulfilled. I have not lost one of those you gave to me. Then, because this is about Peter today, then Simon Peter, my man, who had a sword, drew it and struck the high priest's servant, cutting off his right ear. The servant's name was Malchus. I mean, so this whole scene is here, and Jesus is doing this noble thing of like, let these men go, like, this is me, take me, like, this is all being said so that, like, my whole purpose of life can be fulfilled, right? And then Peter's like, no, I got you, Jesus. And, you know, there's, like, two responses, right? Like, Jesus could be like, thank you. Like, you're right. I wasn't very confident. Like, I'm so glad you took that and you went and defended me. You're, like, good job, Peter. The other is what he actually does. Jesus commanded Peter, put your sword away. Shall I not drink the cup my Father has given me? And from Easter, we would remember that drinking the cup is the wrath of God. In this, Jesus is saying, are you saying I am not going to be the sacrificial lamb? Are you trying to stop me from my purpose in life, what God has given me on this earth to do? Then the detachment of soldiers with its commander and Jewish officials arrested Jesus. And in this moment, right, it feels like Peter is really trying to prove, probably to both himself and the others around him and Jesus, right, that he would do anything for Jesus. Like, in my mind, Peter's like has this narrative. It's like, Jesus questioned my loyalty. But, like, I'll go to battle for you, Jesus. Like, I got you. I will go conquer these people. And, like, listen, I'm putting my life on the line. You said I wouldn't lay it down, but, like, I will go lay it down for you. But the misunderstanding here is that Jesus didn't ask him to go fight fiercely for him. Jesus asked him to follow faithfully. And maybe that looks more like the lamb than it does the lion. So Simon Peter and another disciple were following Jesus. This is after he's been arrested. Because this disciple was known to the high priest, he went with Jesus into the high priest's courtyard, but Peter had to wait outside at the door. The other disciple who was known to the high priest came back, spoke to the servant girl on duty there, and brought Peter in. You aren't one of this man's disciples too, are you? She asked Peter. He said, I am not. You have this great moment where he just cut off an ear, and now he's saying, I am not. It was cold, and the servants and the officials stood around the fire they had made to keep warm. Peter was also standing there with him, warming himself. Meanwhile, Simon Peter was standing there warming himself. So they asked him, you aren't one of the disciples too, are you? He denied it, saying, I am not. One of the high priest's servants, a relative of the man whose ear Peter had cut off, challenged him. Didn't I see you with him in the garden? I mean, this seems pretty convincing, right? Again, Peter denied it, and at that moment, the rooster began to crow. And you have to put yourself in this perspective, right? Peter has, you know, said, like, I will die for you. Like, confidence in speech. And it was questioned. Like, are you sure? Like, you know for a fact that's going to be true. right? And then he shows up and Jesus is getting arrested and he tries to be this macho dude and cut off an ear and he tries to assert like, yeah, Jesus, I'm with you. And Jesus, instead of celebrating him, said, no, that's not what I wanted. So Peter has to be a little discouraged in this moment, right? Like, I don't get what's expected of me. And on top of that, he also has to be a little afraid, right? This guy is a relative to the dude whose ear he cut off, right? I understand maybe a little bit of fear when you're being questioned like that. Like, if he says yes, there's a strong chance that he is now very much in danger. And so he denies it 3 times, just like Jesus predicted. In fact, the book of Matthew records this last denial this way. Then he began to call down curses and swore to them, I do not know this man. It wasn't just this casual no. He didn't just say, no, I don't know him. He was adamant about it. He had to prove to them by any means necessary that he does not know this man. He is not attached to this dude. So he'll make a spectacle. I swear on my mother's grave. I swear on the Bible. Like, I do not know this man. I have never seen him. He's convincing them. And immediately the rooster crows. Then Peter remembered the words of Jesus, the words that he had spoken. Before the rooster crows, you will disown me 3 times. And he went outside and wept bitterly. Let's add one more element to it. Luke 22:61 records that Jesus was being led from one house to another. Right as Peter denied him the 3rd time, they made eye contact. Imagine that moment. I too would go weep bitterly. And so he denies him 3 times. And it's not Peter's shining moment, right? It's not his shining moment. There's been so much potential that's been building. And there's going to be a lot of restoration that's going to happen. But in this moment, it's not his best. Jesus, from this point, was taken, killed, buried, resurrected. And now he has started to appear. He's appeared to those he loves most. He appeared to the women. Then he went and appeared to the disciples, right? And so Peter, at this point, has seen the resurrected Jesus. But they haven't talked yet. The angel told the women when they found out that Jesus was alive, that he was resurrected, the angel told them, go and tell the disciples and Simon Peter. Isn't that crazy? Like, immediately, Jesus is resurrected and he's on Christ's mind. He's on Christ's mind. Broken as he is, denied him, he is on Christ's mind. And so, here's my favorite part, right? You want to know where Peter was after all of this chaos, all this stuff. Like, he's had high moments, he's had low moments, he denied him. Like, Jesus has now been through all of this. He's been killed and buried and resurrected. All of this has happened. You want to know where Peter is? My dude's out fishing. He's out fishing. He's doing what is comfortable to him, what he is good at, what he was doing when Jesus first called him. Because Peter by trade is a fisherman, right? And so he's just out fishing. In my mind, it's kind of like if you're married, right? And your wife has her water broke and you've gone to the hospital with her, right? And she's given birth. And the moment she gives birth, you just go out and you kind of go fishing, right? You just need to chill for a little bit. Got to relax. Got to decompress. Do what you're good at, what you have control over, right? So I'm just going to go fishing. That's what my friend Peter's doing. John 21 says this. Simon Peter, Thomas, Nathanael from Cana in Galilee, the sons of Zebedee, and 2 other disciples were together. And it feels like a weird start to a joke, but it's not. Peter takes 7 of the 11 disciples with him. Because the truth is, when we walk in unforgiven pain, or when we walk in fallenness, we tend to take people with us. So the lesson is don't underestimate what your influence can do. He said, I'm going out to fish, Simon Peter told them. And they said, we'll go with you. So they went out and got in a boat, but that night they caught nothing. Early in the morning, Jesus stood on the shore, but the disciples did not realize yet it was Jesus. He called out to them, friends, haven't you any fish? And imagine the embarrassment to be like, no, we haven't caught anything. I mean, these are fishermen without fish. Now they just look silly. And so it's a crummy day out in the water. And Jesus said, throw your net on the right side of the boat and you will find some. When they did, they were unable to haul in the net because of the large number of fish. And this miracle cracks me up. Because it's like these guys have been out there all night. And they've been fishing. They've been doing all this stuff. And this guy's like, hey, have you tried this spot? And they just went, whew. Like, what? But there's a miracle that happens. And a large number of fish that they can't even pull up. And then the disciple whom Jesus loved said to Peter, worth noting here, this is the book of John, and John loves to refer to himself as the disciple whom Jesus loved. So John said to Peter, it is the Lord. And as soon as Peter heard him say, it is the Lord, he wrapped his outer garment around himself, for he had taken it off, and he jumped in the water. I mean, that is a noble action. As soon as he could get to Jesus, he was going to get to Jesus. How cool. Until you think about the fact that he ditched all his friends pulling up the fish and he ditched them to row back the 100 yards. But still, he wanted to be with Jesus as soon as possible. And it also echoes the fact that he was asked to walk on water. It's just cool. The other disciples followed in the boat, towing the net full of fish, for they were not far from shore, about 100 yards. When they landed, they saw a fire burning of coals with fish there with fish on it and some bread. Jesus said to them, bring some of the fish you have just caught. Jesus said to them, come and have breakfast. None of the disciples dared to ask him, who are you? They knew it was the Lord. Jesus came, took the bread and gave it to them and did the same with the fish. This was now the third time Jesus has appeared to his disciples after he was raised from the dead. When they had finished eating, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? Do you love me more than these? Like if my wife asks me that question, I'm assuming she means more than other women I know or like my friends maybe. But for Jesus to ask Peter this, it was different. Do you love me more than these fish? Which sounds crazy, right? Do you love me more than these fish? Do you love me more than the life you lived before me? Yes, Lord, he said. You know that I love you. And then Jesus said, feed my lambs. Like, what does that have to do with fish? What does that have to do with my love? Again, Jesus said, Simon, son of John, do you love me? He answered, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. Jesus said, take care of my sheep. Again, like, what are you talking about, Jesus? Like, what does that have to do with this love? The third time he said to him, Simon, son of John, do you love me? Peter was hurt because Jesus asked him the third time, do you love me? He said, Lord, you know all things. You know that I love you. Jesus said, feed my sheep. I think we underplay how funny this can be, right? Like, this is a weird thing to command Peter to do. He is a fisherman by trade, and Jesus is talking about all these animals that aren't fish. Like, what do you mean, Jesus? This is not my gifting. This is not what I have grown and known to do. And this has nothing to do with you, right? So, like, what are we talking about? What happens in this moment is so incredible. There's a lot. Jesus affirms Peter 3 times. He's mending what is broken, right? There's 3 denials, 3 affirmations. But there's something deeper happening. Jesus is reminding Peter of a call back in Matthew 16 to leave being a fisherman and to become a shepherd. Not a shepherd to animals, but a shepherd to men. And so in Matthew 16 we read, but what about you, Jesus asked. Who do you say I am? And what a question that is. Simon Peter answered, you are the Messiah, the Son of the living God. Jesus replied, blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah. For this was not revealed to you by flesh and blood, but by my Father in heaven. And I tell you that you are Peter. And on this rock I will build my church. And the gates of Hades will not overcome it. I will give you the keys of the kingdom in heaven. Whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven. And whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven. On this rock I will build my church. What a statement. Upon this foundation. And I think there's 3 elements at play here that we need to discuss. Number one, Peter. You are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church. The name for Peter is Petras. Petras. And it means a rock or stone. And it doesn't mean like this massive rock. Like, it's probably not the cornerstone, right? It's not this whole foundation that a whole shed would be built on. In fact, it means something more like a stone or a pebble, such as one that you would find along a pathway. But what it helps us understand is that Peter will play a role in the church. Like a small stone in a large building. In fact, he is the one that preaches the sermon in Acts 2, where the Holy Spirit descends. And this is often the moment that is considered the start of the modern day church. That's his role. How incredible. And following that, he goes out and he teaches and he shares the gospel. That is his role in the modern day church. So he plays a role. That confession that he made, the one that goes something like this, Simon Peter answered, "You are the Messiah, the Son of the living God." That confession is also central to Christian belief. Like, without this acknowledgement of Jesus, there's nothing distinctly Christian about this movement, about the church. Like, if this isn't said of Jesus, then he's just a dude. If he's not here to be the Messiah, the one to save us, the one sent, the one who is the Son of the living God, then our belief is totally skewed. So it's core that this is part of it. And then the most important rock. Jesus is the rock. He is the only acceptable sacrifice, the only acceptable cornerstone in which a structure can stand. And back in that day, like a cornerstone, everything was built around it. Like, if it's perfectly square, everything else will, because everything was keyed to that one cornerstone. And so Jesus is the cornerstone of the church. The movement of the church has to be about Jesus, or it will crumble much like a shed without a foundation. Matthew 7 tells a parable about the storms coming in, right? And the waters rising, and the house that was built on the sand crumbled. But the house that was built on the firm rock stood. So, church is about this. It's built on this, the rock, the cornerstone. It's built on people meeting together, centralized around the name of Jesus. So if this, like all that we talked to up about this point, if this is all like the church, I don't think it's super confusing. So where does the confusion really come into the picture? Why is this a weird belief? Why are we talking about it? What's odd here? And I want to give some questions that you may have heard, and I want to talk through them a little bit. First, my relationship to God is just that, mine. So what's the point of church? And I hear this a lot. You may not have. Maybe you have, maybe you don't. I've heard this a lot in my circles. That I don't see a reason to show up to a church because I can watch online, I get the sermon, I have friends that are Christians, so like I'm good, right? And it's a fair question. And it's also worth saying, before I even get into this, I mean, you guys are here this morning, right? Like, you guys are here. You showed up. Like, you likely have some answers why you would show up. Why church? Why is that even important to you? But I want to add some further explanation, just broad strokes. Number one, one another. Why church? One another. There are 59 one another's in the New Testament. 59. Here's six. I couldn't fit more on a slide. Here's six. Love one another. We covered that in John 13. Build up one another. Serve one another. Forgive one another. Pray for one another. Bear with one another. We have been gifted the responsibility to live in a Christian community. And I say it that way because living in this Christian community should never be viewed as a burden. Hear this. I get to love my wife. I do not have to love my wife, right? I get to love her. It is a privilege. It is not an obligation. And the way I communicate about it will form what I believe about it. So if I always say, gosh, I just have to love my wife, or I have to go spend a night with her tonight, like I have to go to dinner, what does that tell you about my heart towards my wife? I view her as a task, an obligation, something that I have to show up to. But when I say I get to do this, I get to have a night with my wife, I get to go on a vacation with her, I get to just sit and watch a TV with her, praise God. It tells you that I enjoy her, that it is a gift. And they're very different. So we as a church get to, we as Christians get to love, pray for, be patient with, and serve one another. We get to. And throughout the Bible, it's interesting because throughout the Bible, community is actually just assumed. It's just an assumed statement that we would be a part of community. In fact, in Genesis, it says, it is not good for man to be alone. I mean, that's the statement right there. God's assuming it. Like, it's not good for us to live in isolation. So then why would we do any different in this culture? Why would we think any different? Why would we live in isolation? Is it a choice? Is it forced? I'm going to present a theory. Take it or leave it. Totally up to you. But maybe, just maybe, it's because we as a culture have bought into a style of life that promises connection, seems to give it to us, but ultimately isolates us. And I'm not attacking it, but with the invention of the phone, I think calling and messaging has allowed us to keep in touch with people all over the world. And praise God, like, that's incredible. I'm glad that I can talk to my friend in Sweden. Like, that's incredible, right? I'm gonna talk to my friend in the Bahamas. Like, they're all over the world, and I can still communicate with them. I can keep in touch. That is incredible. But many of us fall into a trap that we never see coming. We fall into a trap that we think we are so connected that we stop trying. We give up. We just don't think it's important because I can connect with anyone I want to at any point, whether you actually do it or not. And you stop making the effort to be face-to-face. To live in authentic connection. Digital connection has now replaced somewhat authentic personal connection. I'll give you an example. My best friend is Jonathan. I grew up with him. We were three doors apart from each other growing up. So, like, all we did was, when I was 5 years old, I would run to his house, see if he was home, and we would hang out if he was. If not, I'd go back. And I would do that like five times a day because I was needy. But We would do that, and that was our connection. And from my age of like 5 to 17, that was what I knew with him. We would always hang out in that way, and we liked video games. I still do. We liked video games, so we'd play them, but we'd play them together, right? Like, we'd be in the same room. We'd be in the same thing. We'd be talking about it, strategizing, but like, we'd be in person. Well, when college came, I stayed in Virginia. He went to Tennessee, and he had lived there, and he found his wife there, and like, I mean, he set up roots there, right? And so for a long time, we adapted what our connection looked like. Sometimes it was months without talking, and then we would have a phone call, and we'd start up again. I mean, regardless, we would always pick up totally naturally. But video games became an outlet for us to connect. And he's my best friend in the world. And so we would connect over video games. We would get on at a certain night, and we would play, and we would talk, and we'd catch up, and it was great. And so in my, like, you know, more present day, we're both married, we're both trying to live life and build households, and we would talk about how incredible it would be if we were back in person, like if we were back in the same area. Like, if only, like, I was in Tennessee or he was in Roanoke and we could make that work. Well, about a year ago, he moved to Roanoke. We know it's temporary, like-ish. We don't know how long he's going to stay, but he's doing nurse practitioner school. And so he's here because housing is free if they live with their parents. And that's very helpful when you're trying to pay for schooling. And so he's here. And about 2 weeks ago, we were talking about how poorly we have done seeing each other face to face. He's here. We talked about how awesome it would be to go climbing and how awesome it would be to go disc golfing and like all these hobbies that we enjoy together. And yet we kind of just resolve back to video games. So he's 20 minutes away, and I still don't see him all that often. And that's our fault. And we're trying to improve on it these days because I've just started thinking about it. And I was like, man, we got to do better, right? All of that to say is something very simple. We live We are made to live in authentic personal community. So when I say one another's, that's point of church, we're made for community. And this is an outlet for it, right? An authentic community in the church specifically is important because it leads to our formation. That God could use others and sermons and worship to convict, encourage, teach, and form us. So is there someone that maybe you struggle to love? God may be using that person to form you. Is there someone that you can confide in? God may be using that person to form you. Is there something from this stage that by God's grace alone, not by me because I am crazy, by God's grace alone, he speaks to you? You may be formed that way. Praise the Lord. So maybe one of the points of church is, you know, because we need connection. Maybe it's formation. Maybe it's contribution. Something we never think about, and it's not money, not even talking about that. It's the fact that you yourself could be a gift, that you, your presence could be a gift, that you could show up on a Sunday and you could give yourself away in a way that benefits the lives of others, that somebody may need you to confide in. We never really think about that, but it matters so much. Like if the inverse was true and we lived our lives in isolation, like if we lived our lives solely for ourselves in isolation, then we're missing a large portion of what we've been created to. We've been created to give ourselves away as a gift. You yourself, whether you believe it in your self-worth or not, are a gift to be given away to others, and that is by God's value of you. So maybe, I said all this and you're like, I totally agree. Maybe you even know a friend and you're like, yeah, I mean, they would say like their problem isn't the fact that it's community or like that or this. Their hindrance looks something more like this. Why would I come to church when the people are either hostile or hypocritical? Again, totally fair. And if we put it in the right perspective, it may help, right? People are broken, not God. So you can't blame God, but that's not what this prompt is saying. But I think it's also helpful to understand, no matter who you are, you're probably going to be a hypocrite to some extent. I hate to say it, but you probably are. Because we all have an ideal standard of living that we would propose for ourselves. And we all, somewhere along the way, don't measure up to it. Right? It's just the church as a whole says we want to be this. We want to seek God and be more like him. And we don't look like that a lot. We fall short of it. And so maybe it's more of a, we need grace for those that are along their journey. And maybe it's like, to be a part of this, we could benefit one another to look more like Christ. Maybe that's how change happens, is that we as a church, as a body of believers, not as a building, come together to help each other along this path. Be less hypocritical. Be less hostile. And especially if we're practicing the one another, the love, serve, patience with, we'll achieve this to some extent. Quick question. Do I have to be a certain measure of good to enter or participate in the church? No. Just a certain level of willing. That's what I'll say. Just a certain level of willing. You have to be willing to have your views challenged. You have to be willing to have your patience challenged. You have to be willing to be a part of a messy family. Like, that's the willing part. You don't have to be a certain level of good because none of us are going to measure up to it. And lastly, what's the good of church? Like, why? And I'm going to just zoom out real quick. Our entire existence is to glorify, to reveal God, and to prepare ourselves for him. Jesus in the Bible is depicted as the groom, and we are depicted as the bride. And so our goal as a body of believers is to prepare ourselves as a bride. The same way that many brides get their makeup done and their hair done, right? Because they want to present themselves beautiful. We want to present ourselves holy. And that's not by our work alone, promise. In fact, Ephesians 5 has a portion about marriage. And it says, husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her, washing her that she may be presented. And so that's our goal. Together, to form one another, to walk with one another, to help the individual walk with God. So our calling as Christians is not to beautify a building, That's cool. It's to beautify the body of believers. And so let me just quickly level with you. I am a PK. I've grown up in the church my entire life. I've seen the good, bad, and the ugly of church. I've seen betrayal, loss, heartbreak. I've experienced people who have encouraged me and people who have frustrated me. Yet all the while, and this is God's testimony alone, yet all the while I've been formed into a man who does love God, who somehow loves others and somehow loves the church. And that is incredible because many PKs don't. And so here's the invitation, right? It's not an easy one. It comes with a road of hardship. The invitation is this: to be a part of the bride of Christ. A messy family, let me tell you that, a messy family. But to find your identity in Christ and then walk alongside others in that journey. That's the invitation. So if you will, would you just bow your heads and pray with me?